Welcome to Failing Up, a podcast where we explore failure.
Why we're afraid of it, why we try to avoid it, and the success that can arise directly from it.
Failure comes in many shapes and forms. It can even mean different things to different people.
This show, Failing Up, intends to explore all aspects. These are the stories of people who have experienced profound failures that ultimately led them to something positive.
We hope this helps us all learn and grow. Thanks for listening. Should we just
awesome,
get going
yeah.
here?
Good K. Going.
Good K, I said.
Good well, K. You didn't bring your iPad.
No, I have my phone, though.
You loser.
I keep my notes on my phone.
Nice.
It's big enough.
Cool.
Yes. You loser. Thank you. What a nice way to start another episode of Failing Up, Eden.
Yes.
Thank you so much for having me in your lovely home again.
Again, you start with this.
You have a lovely home.
Thank you.
And it's a newer place.
But you bring this up every new episode from this season, you've brought this up. People are bored of it.
Okay. Well,
they don't need to
just
know
that Eden lives in a lovely place and has a beautiful view. And I won't say of what, so you know, all your fans don't come down and hunt you out, but it has a beautiful view
of
Los Angeles.
Do you get nervous? I called an Uber yesterday and I didn't tip him because he wasn't great.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh no, I should have tipped him because he knows where I live now.
Yeah. I don't worry. But you're a young lady as well.
Exactly.
So you might have to worry. I don't have to worry as much. I don't think an Uber driver is going
to
come back and be like,
if I get murdered, $2. I have to pay my bills. So that's good.
So we were going to start off the episode. I don't know if you want to do this with fails of the week, right? If we have any.
Okay.
Do you have any fails for yourself for
yes.
the week?
So I went to do a job interview, which is weird. I haven't been on a job interview for a very long time, but I needed a side gig. So I found a cool copywriting gig and I was like, cool, I'll do this. And I'm not used to going to people that don't work in Hollywood. So I was very not professional and like kind of silly. And I don't think they appreciated it very much.
Really?
They were like, what are you doing? Like, it was strange. Yeah.
Like they would say like, what's your biggest strength? And you would make a joke out of it or... You were doing cartwheels?
Stuff like that, yeah. And then they were like, I don't know. It's a weird, like, startup. And they just want someone who's, like, got a witty voice to do copy on the side. And I was like, okay. And they have no idea what it's like. I don't know. It was just so different. I'm not used to it. It just made me realize I probably should not work in not comedy or Hollywood.
Really?
It made me look really I don't think I could do well in a professional field. That takes you too seriously.
Did you walk out and say, I didn't get that job?
Yes.
You
and
knew.
I was also in a bad mood because it was very far. And I was just like, oh, I was in traffic. It's Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
I was just not great.
That is not fun to sit in traffic on a Friday afternoon.
And they made me come up with slogans.
Not get a job. What?
I hope they don't look this up.
On the spot?
Yeah. For like, they're like, we have this back to school thing. Can you think of any like cool puns for back to school? And I was like, no. But like maybe save on back to school deals so you don't have student loans or some shit. I don't know. And they're like, our target audience is millennial moms. And I'm like, I got the millennial part. I'm not really a mom. I'm a mother of many houseplants, but
Just like, couldn't you just been like, don't be a fool, go back to school? Like just rhyme
something.
Oh fuck,
I should have done. I'm not good at stuff like that.
I might have gotten that copyright.
I'm not a good salesperson. And I think that's what they wanted.
Okay.
Ideally. But anyway, so that was my fail. But let's go on to our guest. Because that was not exciting.
And he is not our fail.
But
week.
You guys, you will probably go on job interviews but that you will feel that you can't do. And this might happen to you. So
I've had many a job interview that I totally blew. And at the end, ended up in a better job. So it's usually a good thing when you fail an interview. Something good's coming from that. That's
what
I say.
Yeah.
What do you think our latest guest, actor, writer, comedian, Alex Edelman?
Hi, how's it going? Thank you for having me here at 612 on North Glen Tower Avenue.
Beachwood
nice.
Yeah, you can meet that.
That's not the part we wanted you to
please
comment on.
Thank you. Well, first of all, congratulations on failing out of an office job. It's a great gift to not have to work in an office unless you
There
unless
were
you
many
to.
Dogs there, which was... Very exciting.
Offices can be lovely places to work. I very much enjoyed working at a copywriting, working at an advertising agency called Rain in New York City. I still do some stuff for them. It's like, you know, they were my family. They helped me, you know, get out of various terrible jobs and into sort of the real world. So I think there are times and places for office jobs. But yeah, doesn't sound like you need it, baby. Good job.
Yeah, so it's okay. It's fine. I've got other stuff going on.
Yeah, this is a beautiful house. You don't. If you're that hard up for an office job, you shouldn't be here at 4121 Glen Tower Avenue in Beach. Your address.
I expect many edible arrangements now that everybody has my address.
Sent to this random address in Beechwood Canyon.
I mean, we might need to Snopes this, but did you ever hear the thing about edible arrangements? Supposedly, the owners are Hamas supporters.
Hamas supporters?
Yeah. Like, and
are
like,
you sure they don't?
I'm pretty
just
sure I read the Snopes, and they said like it's questionable because they do
that.
They do give money to
hummus. Are you sure it's not hummus?
No,
that's I read that.
That's why I do Sherry's Berries, and we're not even advertising for Sherry's Berries.
When my dad was sick, someone sent edible arrangements, mm-hmm.
And you're like, get this Hamas garbage out of
my dad out. Was like, he wasn't. He was, you know. He's Jewish and all that stuff, but it wasn't like a Fox News Jewish, mm-hmm. You know, because those exist.
Right.
Those exist.
Oh, yeah, lots of them.
Fox
lots of them.
News Jewish. That's
how Benjamin Netanyahu
that's
got elected.
Like, but it's half of my dad's friends. So when they saw that gift basket, they were like, oh, no, that's Hamas supporter.
You're kidding.
And my dad was like, no, it's fine. Just give me the pineapple. It's good.
I should have known when the happy Rosh Hashanah basket came with a live grenade option. Yeah. You have to pull up the pineapple very slowly. Chag Sameach. There you go.
Exactly.
Oh, that's my God. Weird. We've had so many Jews on this podcast.
I know. We actually had two. We just had 2 weeks of Hebrew in a row now.
Who is the other Jew? There can only be one Jew.
Last week was Amir Blumenfeld. And so we...
Just from Jake and Amir.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Is that how you pronounce his last name? I know Amir pretty well.
Maybe.
Amir Blumenfeld.
Yeah. We went to high school together.
Did I say it wrong?
Oh, really? He is awesome. I'm a big
Jewish high school.
I'm a big Amir fan.
Yeah.
And so we spoke some Hebrew. I don't know if
it
annoyed. No, I didn't.
Yeah, you did. I listened to it again, and I was like, where's the Hebrew?
You listened back to your own podcast? Lame.
No, okay. I left the Hebrew in there.
Because he said that, and I was like, I don't think he left it in. And
I 100% did.
Sorry.
It was in the very beginning of the show. I know sometimes when you listen back, you miss some stuff.
Anyway.
You wouldn't think you'd miss Hebrew. Do you speak Hebrew? You grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family?
I grew up
correct?
In an Orthodox Jewish family. I do speak a bit of Hebrew. I understand. Ani mevin aval ani lo medaber.
Wow.
I speak. You just said I speak very good in Hebrew.
So.
Oh, it's just for fun. Yeah, I just do it for fun. Okay, fine. See, I understand.
Okay.
Right now, everyone who's listening has turned off.
I know.
Right now.
That's what I said last time.
I literally
time.
Said the same thing you said last week, like the same sentence. I went, yeah.
Oh my God. I didn't realize that there was that Jews do run
that's
Hollywood.
What you do. Yeah.
Headquartered here at 4121 Beechwood Canyon. Sorry.
We're going to do such a callback to that, yeah. By the way.
When you're a young boy, did you dream of being a rabbi?
I didn't dream of being a rabbi, but I didn't see myself headed in that direction.
Yeah.
You did?
Did you dream of being a rabbi?
Well, you never know. I
when you were a young boy, did you dream of being a spiritual accountant?
Some people want to do that, you know?
Some people.
What did you dream of as a young Orthodox Jewish boy?
I dreamed of a life in professional sports.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Specific sport or just
baseball? Well, I was most proficient at ice hockey. I was a very decent ice hockey player growing up in Boston, but I was I got a job at the Red Sox just after my 13th birthday, so I was very very serious about baseball.
What kind of job do you get with the Red Sox?
Public relations. I wrote the kids newsletter for the Red Sox.
That's ridiculous.
What a killer job.
How does that even start? Were they advertising for 13-year-olds?
I literally just kept showing up at the ballpark, and this very kind woman named Colleen Riley took pity on me and brought me in and showed me to this guy named Charles Steinberg and said, can we keep him? And that was my joke. Yes. Can we keep
like a
him?
Rescue.
Can we keep him? And yeah, they said, yeah, we can keep him. So they kept me there until 2007. And then I went to the Dodgers for 2 years. And that ended so badly.
What happened with the Dodgers?
I guess we're getting into our first failure.
Yes.
Yeah, there we go.
Really, do you want to just get into it?
Please. Get into it.
I got hired away from the Red Sox. I had a sick job at the Red Sox. And I got hired away for an even sicker job at the... working for Dr. Charles Steinberg, the guy I mentioned, working at the Dodgers. And I was part of this sort of spate of Boston Red Sox employees being hired away to work at the Dodgers by Jamie and Frank McCourt, who were two Bostonians who had bought the LA team.
Right.
I remember.
And then they got a very acrimonious divorce, and my superiors were dismissed outright, and I was dismissed outright as well. And that functionally ended my career in baseball, actually. I spent 1 year in Milwaukee for the Brewers, but that was utter misery.
Oh no.
What kind of stuff are you doing? I'm a huge baseball fan. What kind of stuff are you doing for the Red Sox?
Yeah, you and
for
your Yankees Dodgers? Hat.
Public relations. You know, I wrote speeches, press releases, pregame ceremonies, came up with a few ideas that some of which were implemented, most of which were just sort of nice ideas, but mostly I just sat and learned what it took to work in an office. I think you know, speaking of office
jobs, that's what I needed to do.
Yeah, your life, I think, until you turn, you know, a certain age, for some people it's 21, for some people maybe, you know, 30, is just learning to, you know, be around people. Like, you learn how to do stuff, and you learn how to teach how to do stuff, and you learn how to work with others. Like, you know, your office jobs are just a series of learning how to do that.
This is true.
So yeah, it was great though. I was at the Red Sox for two World Series in 2004 and 2007. And then I went back to the Red Sox in 2013 for just a little bit of help. After the Boston Marathon bombing, I helped Dr. Steinberg a little bit with the pregame ceremony for the first game back after the bombing. And that was super emotional and fun. And I was on the field for that. And and then they won the World Series later that year. So I was around for three World Series at the Red Sox, the three World Series this century. It was very cool. I've been super blessed.
That's insane.
Hashtag blessed.
So yeah, you're a Red Sox
fan,
obviously.
You're a baseball boner.
Yeah, dude, it's so funny. I've had this whole, you know, I had this whole career that was basically done by 21 years old.
Yeah.
I crashed out, and I crashed out hard. Like, my parents are like, you're going to look for another job after Milwaukee? And I was like, I will never go to another baseball game ever again.
Really? What happened with Milwaukee that was so terrible?
I was just super underemployed, I guess would be the word. You know, I got hired because one of the Brewers people who was out here, who knew me from the Dodgers, sort of took pity on me and got me a job there. But I was like a media relations intern, and I had just come from a very high responsibility, not high powered, but a high responsibility job at the Dodgers. And then I was there looking for more stuff to do. And they're like, no, you're an assistant. You do less stuff. And I was like, no, but this is because what else was I going to do in Milwaukee? Like, get drunk?
That's
what people do
it,
in Wisconsin.
Right?
That's like when I was 16, I was a PA. See, I'm from LA, so
sure.
I had to, like, I worked on sets for a very long time. Mm-hmm. When I was like, so when I was 16, I got a job working on a set as a PA, and it was such a low budget set that they made me do literally everything, stuff sure. I shouldn't be doing.
Sure.
And they gave me too much responsibility.
Yeah.
And I just got my driver's license, and they're giving me the dailies to deliver to, like, post production. I'm like, if I get in a car accident, which I will, because I'm 16. Like,
oh my gosh.
Your movie's done. Like,
yeah. Oh my God.
So, you know, talk about over. I was overemployed, and you were underemployed.
Yeah, that sounds like overemployment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you just told a story that's the opposite of my story.
Well, it wasn't success, but.
That counts as a success.
Do you travel with the team?
I did once or twice, you know, when I was on the Dodgers. We went to, like, San Diego with them, and I went to the World Series in Colorado with the Red Sox and flew back on the team plane after we won in 2007. That was pretty cool.
That's pretty amazing.
Dude, I had a great life. I had a great baseball life. But, you know, it was all over. But it was all over essentially by, you know, 22, 23. And once you see the sausage get made, I think you stop being as big a fan as you used to be.
Are you not a big fan anymore?
I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of baseball. And I do still have a love for the Red Sox that is so earnest and sentimental and boring that I couldn't possibly talk about it publicly. Like, you know, I love the Red Sox because of all the things they represent and what they meant to my city and my family. But no, I don't love baseball in the way that I used to. I love it as sort of like America's church, you know, like I think it's a very, but you know, Major League Baseball and baseball are two different things. And the Red Sox and Major League Baseball are two different things. And people talk about, you know, being allegiant to like one team to the fucking exclusion of all others. And they, you know, they love the Red Sox so they hate the Yankees, or they love the Mets so they hate the Yankees, or they're a fan of any team so they hate the Yankees. Yeah. So like, but you know, it's pointless. These are all just, you know, businesses. These are all businesses that are owned for a few years, and they go out and they ingratiate themselves to other local businesses and the local community. But at the end of the day, they are businesses, and they could move office buildings to another city at any time. And, you know, you root for, you're rooting for
Corporation.
You're rooting for a corporation. Someone said rooting for the Yankees was like rooting for U.S. Steel. That was back
then. That's a good analogy.
It's a really good analogy.
Gotta go. But no, that's super interesting, though. I mean, especially as a baseball fan itself, like, so the diamond has lost its luster a little bit.
No, I should backpedal on that.
I dropped my phone.
Good job.
Thank you.
I don't know if that's true. Not that the diamond has lost its luster, but the things that I love about baseball now are very different than the things that I loved when I was a kid. You know, like, I admire different things in baseball players and baseball teams and baseball executives now than I did when I was a child, and I actually understand some things, I think, a little better now, or I'll admire things a little more, like certain teams that have invested in growing players out of the Dominican Republic, or teams that have invested, like these are very boring technical things that I'll find easy to admire, or like an organization that has a very non-hierarchical structure, or an organization that promotes women, which I think is really cool. Like the Houston Astros had a really exciting woman named Steph Wilka working for them, and like there are a whole bunch of teams that are really great about employing women, and there are a whole bunch of teams that are really not great at or paying their employees a prevailing living wage. When I left baseball, there was a statistic that I read that 40-something% of front office employees had their income subsidized by their parents, which is a huge, huge amount, because those jobs, everybody wants them, so they're free to pay people like, you know, 40 grand, 50 grand a year. It's bad. It's a real bad, bad system.
I read this whole thing about cheerleaders, not for baseball, but for like the NBA.
NFL. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the NBA.
And
NFL.
They get paid shit. And they get so much stress factors and just horrible stuff happening to them. And they just want the glory of being a cheerleader for like the Cowboys or whatever. But they pay them so low because they know they can.
Yeah, they can. And, you know, people audition. It's a supply and demand game, baseball. And you need to have mentors that are willing to sort of drag you from team to team. And at some point, you need to prove yourself to be. Also, I wasn't willing to keep doing a certain thing, which was working a crazy life balance I kept waiting to show what potential I had. And I also thought that comedy was a better venue, actually, comedy and writing. And I had a boss. I've had people, though, who tremendously impacted my life. The thrust of your podcast is that failures that have helped you, right?
Sure.
So like the people that I met at those teams and the lessons that I picked up from those. Is this too earnest?
No.
Are you sure?
What? Don't even have to ask. No.
Oh, no. There's this guy, Larry Lucchino, who is my boss at the Red Sox, who's an absolutely wonderful chief executive, who, you know, I still stay in touch with. This dude was like the biggest world beater you could possibly imagine. Like, went to this high school in Pittsburgh, got himself a basketball scholarship to Princeton, played on the Final Four team with Bill Bradley, the guy who ran for president.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
And then moved to Washington, D.C., was a paralegal on the Watergate trial with Hillary Rodham, who wasn't Hillary. People forget that, by the way. Hillary Clinton was a paralegal on the Watergate case. Like, she's, you know, she's been in the spotlight since that.
Yeah.
And then his boss, Edward Bennett Williams, asked him to be the president of the Redskins and the Orioles, and then he owned and ran the San Diego Padres, where he built a stadium, the best stadium in baseball, besides Fenway Park, I think. And then he owned the Red Sox, and now so this guy's got a lot of wisdom, and and so like different things that he'd throw off, like I'd take as gospel, you know, like God is in the details. So like my comedy is very detail oriented, and like I know it sounds silly, but like started to really care about things that I didn't care about after. And he told me that was important to travel. So like I think more than any other young American comic, I use heavy air quotes here, but my career is dictated by the amount of travel that I've done. Like, you know, I perform a lot in Australia and England and, you know, Europe and other places where you might not think a comedy career would benefit from. But you know, because of Larry telling me again and again to travel, he'd also say everything before 30 is prologue. So so I guess approaching 30, I better figure out the end of the prologue and start. How old are you?
I turned 30.
Yeah. Pretty good spending of your prologue if you ended up here at 6141 Beechwood Canyon.
Right.
I did buy my house a month after I turned 30.
That's awesome.
But it was like a long time of searching. And I felt like my 29th year was like such a mess.
So. I'm 29 and I feel like it's kind of it's a beautiful mess. Some things are going well, but I'm also like, Right. I'd like to. I turned 29 the day before I went to, like, I had a crazy day the day I turned 29. So, like, it's not, I had a horrible, it was the weirdest, most strange day of my entire life, probably.
It's weird that a strange day would happen on your birthday.
Yeah. Well, like, partially it was because it was my birthday.
Okay.
Like, I was in England. I had a serious, like, chat with my girlfriend. My girlfriend lives in England. So we had a chat, and then I got on the train, and there was a group of school kids sitting there, and they sort of sussed out that it was my birthday, and then they sang happy birthday to me on the train.
That's kind of cute.
It was like hugely, and then I, you know, got off the train, cried immediately, tweeted about it, got on the airplane because I was on my way to the airport, and the kids were like, oh, you don't have anyone saying happy birthday to you on your birthday because you're traveling. That's a shame. And they start saying happy birthday.
Oh, geez.
So I tweeted that. Which is way too earnest for a comedian to tweet, by the way. I landed in the hole, in the hole, like, turned on my phone, and my phone had just, like, exploded with notifications and stuff like that. And so, like, and then I went to dinner with my friend, you know, Milana Weintraub?
Yeah, we're good friends.
Dinner, and, like, Milana and I had dinner, and then I mean, that was my birthday. That was, like, March
20th. That's fun.
Yeah, but it was
weird. Her birthday's in March, too.
Yes. She is... early March, probably.
Early March.
She's such a delight. She's the
greatest. I've known her since high school.
We've interviewed
really?
Her.
Really? Yeah.
What high school did you go to?
We didn't go to the same one. We both lived in, like, Beverly Hills adjacent area. So she went to Beverly, and I went to Milken, which was the Jewish school.
Oh, man. I'm fascinated with the guy who the high school is named after.
Michael Milken?
I'm so fascinated.
He taught us math one day.
What? Really? Did he tell you how to sell?
No, but he taught us how to calculate large numbers in our heads without using a calculator.
Really?
And I remember coming home and telling my dad what happened. He's like, oh my God. Like, do you know what he taught you? Like, only a criminal would, like, teach you that kind of shit.
Wait, what did he teach you? Repeat that?
Like, he taught us basically how to do, like, multiplication with really large numbers without using a calculator, like, in our head. And I was like, this is why this guy has junk bonds.
Yeah, well, you know, Michael Milken, fun fact to connect him back, Larry Lucchino, the guy I mentioned, the CEO, the person who he worked for, Edward Bennett Williams, was a very famous Washington trial lawyer, and his last client was Michael Milken, and he passed away before Milken went to trial. And Edward Bennett Williams didn't lose a client to jail for like 10 years. And I was chatting with somebody this week who used to work for Michael Milken, and he said if Edward Bennett Williams hadn't died, then the outcome of his life may have been very different.
I mean, he did okay.
Oh, he's done incredibly well. He's a success story.
I know. He built a school.
For people that don't know, should we explain? Do you know who we're talking about?
Yes. I mean, I'm familiar with Milken him, but Institute? I probably don't know enough as well. So I say explain.
Michael Milken was a junk bond trader from the 80s. And he traded high, sort of like stuff that's...
Junk bonds.
Yeah, a second cousin to the things that The Big Short was about.
Sure.
And the prosecuting attorney was Rudy Giuliani, prostitute.
Definitely.
And this prostitute sent... it's so funny. You think that the guy who put away the junk bond person... Who do you think is more well thought of now? Because Milken got out of jail after, you know, 2 years.
Right, cupcake prison.
Yeah, and he built schools and has become a major philanthropist and, you know.
He has, like, an institute. He gives tons of money to, like.
Brady shows up to talk at his, you know, at his ideas conference. Right. And Rudy Giuliani's on TV shilling for the worst person who's ever lived.
Getting booed at Yankee Stadium.
Yeah.
He was the mayor on 9/11.
I love New York so much because of that.
Do you hear his defense, by the way?
He had a defense?
He said, "I was saying Boo Earns."
Yeah, that's basically what it was. Jenny, do you know that I was saying Boo Earns?
Who's the
Simpsons reference?
It's a Simpsons reference.
I don't watch enough Simpsons.
Someone said, Mr. Burns is getting booed, and he goes, "Smithers, are they booing me?" And Smithers goes, "No, sir, they're saying Boo Earns." And so that's Giuliani's defense was like, "They weren't booing me; they were just showing their affection."
That's
so
how New Yorkers do it. No, yeah. No, that is not how
they were
New Yorkers.
They were saying Boo Earns, Boo Giuliani.
That's awful.
He's
such a shit.
Let's back up for a second. So you're 21 when you're done with baseball,
22,
Milwaukee.
Yeah.
22 with Milwaukee. Okay, so now. You say to yourself, what am I going to do with my life?
Do you have a quarter life crisis?
Or do you know already?
Like I had a quarter life crisis. Yeah. What was your quarter life crisis?
I think I'm still in it.
Don't flatter yourself. This is not, you're not, if you think you're a quarter of the way through, you think you're going to live to 120?
I think, no, not at all.
Okay.
But I just don't like saying midlife crisis when you're like.
Fine, 30. You're having a third life crisis.
There you go.
Fine. I don't know. I honestly, probably the end of the life crisis for all we know. I think I had it around like 25, shortly after my dad died, where I was just like, Oh. Oh my God, I don't have parents and like I have property.
Are you an orphan?
I'm an orphan.
Okay.
How else do I have a house? I inherited it.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm being earnest.
No, go for it.
So it's just like, what do I, you know, I have no one telling me to go to get my teeth cleaned.
You just have to get your teeth cleaned.
I have to kick my own ass.
I haven't been in a year.
I know. It's, yeah, you have to, but luckily mine calls me. I have a very nice woman named Ronit. She's very Jewish.
Yeah, clearly.
She calls me every 6 months. She's like, honey, you have to come in and get your teeth cleaned with Miss Dr. Weinstein. No, she doesn't say that.
Oh.
But she's a great receptionist, and she calls me and gets. And anyway, I had to learn how to.
You have the weirdest corporate sponsors: off-brand edible arrangements, a teeth cleaning place run by the most aggressive Israelis.
I know, yeah. It's crazy. But basically, I just had to learn how to be an adult for myself and be my own parent and
sure.
my own ass.
Yeah,
which is hard. So that was my quarter life crisis.
Sure.
Did you feel like you had yours after?
I mean, I've had a fucking crazy. You know, 7 years since 2012 when I finished college. I was very adrift. I really didn't know what I was going to do or where I was going to go. I got a job where, thank God, this copywriting agency, Rain, gave me a bit of a cushion after college. I worked with them and for them and found and saved up money. I went to this thing called the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a play.
That's in England.
England. Yes. I thought it was going to be awesome. It was the one of the worst months of my life. The woman hadn't completely written the play.
Oh, that's bad.
Yeah. I showed up a week before and I was like, oh, I thought it was going to be awesome. And because the pages she sent for the heavy air quotes auditions were awesome. And then I showed up and it was a nightmare because she was like, hey, I haven't fully written it. Didn't know that till I got to England.
What?
Very, very bad accommodation. I remember. It rained almost every day.
That's England.
Well, it was Scotland in the summer, and I was like, I didn't know.
It's August usually. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was walking around in these galoshes, and one day I accidentally tucked my rain pants into my galoshes, and it was like a 45-minute walk to the venue from where I was staying. And I looked down at some point, and because of the way my rain pants were inclined, I looked down and rain was overflowing out of my boots. And I thought, this is pretty much the worst. Like, this is bad. But, you know, I guess, and this does feel so earnest, but like, that was a really informative experience for me. I saw these great comedians who had great British comics who had all this cool stuff to say. I felt like I had something to say, you know, based on those experiences working in offices and how frustrated I felt to be underemployed as a young person. I did this show about young people called Millennial just as the word was starting to enter the vernacular. So I think the show was okay, but I think it benefited a tremendous amount from people wanting to understand a little more about the Millennial generation. And that was 2014. So that's almost 4 years ago. And it won this award in Edinburgh that sort of changed my life and gave me and it comes with a cash prize that sort of gave me a bit of a financial cushion. And then, my life sort of picked up a little bit. I got an agent, got a manager, got some movie writing gigs and stuff like that. And, wrote a follow-up show called Everything Handed to You, which was just about like Jewish identity and stuff like that. And that one did well critically and commercially. So, but like all this stuff was very like the artistic equivalent of paycheck to paycheck, right? Like if one thing failed, then, you know.
Absolutely. Well, that's how artists kind of live, no matter what your art is, I feel. Like if you're a writer or an actor or even just literally just an artist with like a paintbrush, it's really like, what's your next gig?
Right,
sure.
What's your next paycheck?
But do you feel like, you know, I do this very specific thing, which is stand-up comedy. And
yeah.
Not just stand-up comedy, these sort of hour-long shows with integrated narratives. And so like people who see it, you know, I'm pretty clubby stand-up. I'm really more of a comedy club stand-up than anything else. But like, I feel like basically I'm doing this weird like magic trick, and it's only so long before someone's gonna be like, okay, buddy, we see what you're doing. It's just comedy club stand-up, you know, in the guise of a one-person show, and that'll be it, you know?
No, I don't think you should look at it like that. I think I used to write jokes for magicians. So I used to deal with their egos.
Wait a second. Okay, fine. Finish your thought, but we're not leaving this alone.
But like, I've seen people, at least magic people, if you're making that analogy, like thinking, oh my gosh, like how long can I keep this show up? Like, it's going to be like, it's got like a dancer. It's got like an expiration
date. I mean, sure. Forever. People who go see magic are fucking idiots. Oh my God.
I mean, yes and no, but like, they're all fine. I've seen like 70-year-old magicians still doing it and they're still.
That's a problem. That sucks. I have a real issue with magic, which is that they don't write their own tricks.
Oh, see? Yeah. Okay. Well, that's
I
a
hate
whole other
that
thing.
So
like
much.
You think it's trick plagiarism in a sense?
Yeah, you can't go if you can't walk into a comedy store and buy an act, but there's a great magic shop in Seattle where people walk in, you know, spend $10,000 and walk out with, you know, without a year's worth of bookings. Fuck that.
Here's the thing. Like, there was a really infamous problem. Remember this guy on America's Got Talent called Collins Key?
100%.
Right. He did a trick that Justin Willman, who's a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm. I love Justin Willman. Yeah. I think Justin, that there are exceptions. Justin Willman's an exception. Yeah. Penn and Teller are exceptions. Oh, he's great.
But Justin Willman did that trick on Ellen, the exact same trick. Mm-hmm. And that trick costs about like $11,000.
$11,000 to do or $11,000 to purchase?
To purchase.
Okay, see, that's fucked.
I know, but listen to this. So when he did that trick, people, mm-hmm. all those magic message boards, which I didn't know existed, but Justin was like, yeah, they exist. Look at it.
All
and
the
I
magic
did.
Magic what?
The magic like forums and
Ugh,
boards.
God damn it.
All
Can
these
you imagine
magic
how tiresome
things?
Somebody is. If
I know.
Yeah, go ahead.
And they're like, Colin stole Justin's trick. And then they're like, it took a few people to be like, no. Justin bought that trick, performed it first on TV, and then Colin did it. And then
was Justin upset about it?
He was a little upset, especially because like Colin kind of like played it out like, you know, like, oh,
it's
my
never
thing.
Been done.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, so his wife, Jill, is a really good friend of mine. We went to a
Colin and Jill.
No, Justin.
Or Justin and Jill.
Justin's wife.
You went to high school together?
We didn't. We actually used to have a podcast together, but yeah. we went to a convention and we saw Colin there. So we wanted to take a picture with him and Justin wanted to post it and be like, this guy steals everything from me.
Oh, God damn it.
That would be funny.
That'd be really cute.
Yeah. But anyway, but like it is kind of fucked up that like, yeah, like you could buy a magic trick and it could be performed. And the thing is with magic is that like.
I resent that so fucking much.
I know. It sucks.
Even like there's a guy named David Kwong or David Kwong.
Yeah.
I think he's all right. I like him as a
guy.
He's
good friends with Milana, so.
yeah, no, I think they did a show together recently this week.
Yeah, I did a show with him too.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's great.
He's more of a puzzle guy, though.
Sure, but I like that. Whenever I see a magician who's actually cool, I'm like, this is such a rarity that you like. I take such issue with magicians and comics. Probably shouldn't. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't be saying this,
but like,
I really
some people don't write their own material. Like Tosh doesn't write his own material.
Oh come on, that's crazy.
Yeah, he has like a few writers. He's like five or six writers.
I don't know, man. That's a real specific comedy aesthetic, right, Daniel Tosh?
It is a specific aesthetic, but a lot of very like famous and rich comics hire other comics.
I've written
to write.
For some famous comedians, but you know. I think you have to, you start on your own and you establish a persona and you establish a thing that is you.
Sure.
And jokes that aren't you don't often work or they,
that's true.
There's diminishing returns. Just, and I'm not crazy about, I have a real bee in my bonnet about Frank Sinatra. Like besides the fact that I think he was a terrible human being, he's a real, real piece of shit.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is he didn't write his own music. My way. He's like, I did it my way. And I'm like, that's not your song.
No.
Now the irony of you singing a song about originality and unwillingness to do anything that's not personally sacred to you, and it's been written by like a team of four dudes who you barely know, and like one of them who never met you. Like it's very strange that this guy's like, he was so original, Frank Sinatra. He's such a American. He's one of the last unique Americans. Yeah. This guy is. Terrible dude who picked fights with people in bars because they're better looking than him. Like, just a weirdo.
But it's like,
fuck Frank Sinatra.
I do feel like, especially with comedy, like it does, you should have your own voice. And mm-hmm. that's really what makes you unique and a good comic.
Sure.
Is that it's like they could, oh, that's a Seinfeld joke or,
right.
You know, that's a, you know, Joan Rivers joke. Like it's mm-hmm. very, having like a, just a, I guess a brand.
Sure.
You know you're a redneck if. Yes, I agree. my absolute.
You know what?
Favorite.
That's a specific. You know I would defend that. I defend that shit to the bone. You might be the blue collar comedy guys. That's who they are. That shitty.
They make more money than me.
They make more money than all of us combined. But that's not why. That's not an indicator of. Obviously, it's not an indicator of merit. But what is an indicator of merit is the fact that, you know, that's who those guys are. These guys are fucking rednecks. They wear proudly and, you know, they're like. The blue collar comedy tour is very much their thing. God, you can't get two comedians together and have them not eventually start talking about comedy. You could be like, this is a podcast about nuclear physics. And then, you know, 10 minutes in, they're like, do you know that Robin Williams joke about nuclear physics? And then it's over. Right. That's it.
Let's go back, though. You're 22 years old. You leave baseball. You say to yourself, I'm going to go and write for the ad agency. Thank you. But then eventually you say to yourself that I'm funny enough to do comedy. Like, where does that all come from?
I started doing comedy seriously after high school. When I got to NYU, which is where I went to college, I was really serious about it. I would go to comedy clubs every night, watch comedy, get a little bit better. I was terrible. I was terrible till I was about 22, 23. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't figure it out till pretty late. It's a pretty intense trial and error process. You want to talk about learning about...
Were you getting booed? Were you getting just
crickets?
No,
I wasn't getting booed. I wasn't even not doing well. I was just fine. You know, there's nothing worse than being fine.
Yeah.
Mediocre.
Right? Yeah, it was...
You weren't standing out.
I wasn't... Yes, exactly that. That's a good way of... I would even kill occasionally, but I would never stand out. You know, there wasn't anything special there. So, okay. Like... And I only figured that out from watching other special comedians. The things that made comedians special was a real appeal to the elements of your persona. Like, someone who's a little bit over earnest would be a little bit over earnest, or someone who's a little more sardonic. Like, and the more authentically you could sort of portray, I think there are two aspects to a comedian. There's the content, and then there's the aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And when comedy is at its best, the two inform one another. The content informs the aesthetic informs the content. And so, like, I watch comedians who are really, really distinct aesthetic and really distinct content. And I was like, fuck, I'm just doing jokes. I'm not doing anything interesting. So, you know, I worked at it a little bit. And in 2014, it kind of came together. So I stopped doing the ad agency work so much. Did a little bit through 2015 remotely. Mm-hmm. But by then, you know, was sort of on my way to doing a thing. And then in 2016, I got a job on a CBS sitcom as a staff writer. And, you know, since then I've worked pretty steadily as a stand-up and writer and touring and all that other stuff.
It's funny how, like, I feel sometimes getting to a place where you're comfortable with your comedy takes really knowing who you are as
That's
a person.
That's what I was going to say. That's funny.
And it's like, it's such a, like, this is why I tell people, you got to give comedians, like, therapy, because they need to really...
Sure.
Like, it's such a big part of, like, we have to understand who we are. And, like, some people will, like, they're, like, mm-hmm. 50 years old and they never reflected on what their identity
sure,
is.
Sure, sure. You're just like, why am I basically doing, you know, jerk-off stuff every day?
Well, asking yourself, like, who am I is, like, such a interesting question, a very deep question. But I think one that comedians often ask themselves in order to, like, help their comedy and kind of figure out what their tone is and all that stuff.
Sometimes the only question I have, sometimes I go, is this a living? Is this a way?
Really?
You know?
Yeah. I think that's your Jewish parents.
Well, you know, my parents are super supportive, really. Everyone's like, oh, do your parents? My dad's a doctor. My mom's, you know, a lawyer. So people are like,
oh my God, they're like a Jewish dream team.
They are, but they're like, are your parents disappointed? It's like, are you fucking kidding? Do you think your parents want anything for you other than for you to be happy?
That's true.
Because if they do, then, you know, they worry about me all the time, you know.
Sure.
My dad was a little too supportive. He was like, dude, like, I left college to go to culinary school.
Sure.
And he was just like, yeah, if that's what makes you happy, if that's what you want to do, go for it.
Sure.
And like, I've heard all these really great comedians are like, yeah, my dad didn't give a shit about me. And I'm like, my dad was too supportive for me to be funny.
No, your dad, your parents, having a healthy upbringing. There are some things that you can't, you know, buy. Like, I've worked or toured with super successful people, and sometimes after a few days with them on the road, I go, boy, I'm so happy I'm not you. We're all famous people who are, you know, broken in a way that no amount of money or success can change.
Yeah.
And so having a healthy relationship with your parents is something that people spend a lot of time and money trying to get back if they don't have it. So,
that's true.
So, you know, just sometimes I have a friend named Phil Wang, who's a really funny British comedian. And he sometimes talks about his father and how his father was supportive. And he's like, oh, fuck you, dad. Like, I need, you know, where's the, do you want me to fail? Like,
yeah, he needs angst, essentially.
Yeah, but, you know, you don't need it. No amount of, that's the same thing. Like, I see people wanting victimhood sometimes. They're like,
that's so weird to me. Like, why do you want to be the victim?
Oh, I think a lot of people do. I think a lot of people now.
For pity?
For pity's sake. Or I think life is a series of, in some ways, of scoreboards, right? Or at least a component of life. And there's a big scoreboard up on the wall, and, you know, your score is lower than somebody else's in terms of in terms of money or in terms of success, and you point at the scoreboard and you go, well, that's not fair because, you know, I started lower than you actually think I started at, and so like it's really a bigger jump than this other person. But like,
yeah,
you know, this cult, I think we're living in a culture of people now wanting very much to be victims and heroes, and I think it's really interesting. I have, you know, I've been very privileged growing up. You know, I grew up in a very stable home with two parents and who loved me and did all they could to. I was a very difficult child, so I
really, you think so?
Absolutely, the most difficult child.
What's your problem?
What's your problem?
ADHD, okay. Dyslexia, a very interesting cocktail of learning disabilities that, you know, some of which were taken seriously in high school and others of which didn't get to until college. But, you know, like, I've been very lucky. I've had a lot of good help. You know, like someone less privileged than me wouldn't have gotten the, yeah, you know, assistance that they needed to find the thing that. That was I was a kid with learning disabilities who struggles to read and write, and I want to be a reader and a writer. So right. I was
dyslexic growing up, yeah, and yeah. I had help, and I went to a Jewish day school, and they had a guidance counselor help me, and like they literally took me out of English class, and I had to like practice.
But you know, you drive yourself crazy. People sometimes go, I got accused of being neurotypical, I mentioned it to my dad, and my dad's like, you're not neurotypical. And yeah. I was like, oh, great. I get to put something up in the victim column, you know? Now I'm a victim. But do I get to put it up in the victim column? Because I got a lot of help. So, you know, I don't know if I'm privileged, but maybe it would be healthy to just, you know, stop thinking of things in terms of who is a victim and who is, John Safran, not John Safran Foer, but there's an Australian documentary guy named John Safran, and I went to see him speak when I was in Melbourne in April. And he was really funny. He said he was accused of something by someone. He was criticizing these black racists, these black Nazis in Australia. And someone said it's really, you know, they said really uncomfortable to watch a white person take issue with black racists. And John Safran showed the tweet up on the screen. And then he looks at the audience. And this line cracked me up. He went, now this guy's Asian, which isn't black, but it's something. And it really, you know, I think we are living in sort of like, because there is so much oppression that we're starting to deal with now in a serious way. I think we're also seeing a lot of people who are like, oh God, you know, this, you know, these people are so oppressed. I'm so oppressed as well because, you know, there's a culture of victimhood now that I think is pretty special.
People want to, and also I feel like I was talking to my friend who's an animator from Israel, and she's like, I don't get these Americans. Like, she went to this YouTube thing, festival, award show, and she's like, people are like coming out and giving up like speeches about their depression, and they're all like applauding. And she's like, in Israel, we're like all depressed. We always say we're depressed. Like,
sure.
Why are we applauding? Like, oh, big, you know, fucking deal. You're depressed? Join the club.
Everyone's like, a hero. Everyone's a hero like, now.
Like, you have to have this whole big statement that you're depressed. She's like, why? We're all, yeah, of course we are. We're all creative people. Like, in Israel, we don't give a shit. Like, and I was like, I like that mentality.
So yeah. I was thinking, Alex, one of the things that kind of popped into my head, you know, I know comedians. It's hard enough to get booked in your own town, let alone in the United States as a whole. But you're getting booked in England, in Australia. Like, how do you even pull that off? How do you have the wherewithal? Are you doing it? Is this an agent? And why are you even saying that? Okay, so you didn't do that on your own. But why are you saying, hey, I want to go to Australia? Or is it because of your mentor that told you to travel? Or is there another good reason?
Well, my impetus for wanting to travel was, you know, being told that it was a good thing to do. And also my parents encouraged me to do what I wanted. And I thought, well, I'd like to go different places and see different things. I still very much have that. Even when I'm here in LA, I'm always trying to get out and do stuff. And, you know, my girlfriend's really a homebody. So sometimes she really gets irritated that, you know, I'm out there doing things.
Does your act change in England?
Totally the same.
Really?
Yeah.
They don't have a different sensibility. There's nothing that...
Totally the same.
And Australia, same thing.
I keep everything the way it is. I am not... I think there are probably differences. I've never thought seriously about the differences.
You don't substitute ham and cheese for Vegemite in Australia.
I mean, there are a few words.
I don't know. I mean, first of all, ham and cheese. There's three Jews sitting around, but...
There are a few words and phrases, I'm sure, that I've changed because, you know, the word bangs... is fringe in England, and you know, but there are very few words that they don't understand Americans using, because television has sort of permeated the culture in every English speaking and some non-English speaking countries. But I don't change anything.
And plus, like, if we get like a British comic or an Australian comic, they're not going to change their act to sound more American.
No, but what I really try to do is I do notice sometimes that Americans abroad tend to talk about similar things. Mm. So I try really hard to avoid that. And British people who come over here tend to go, what's that about? You know, you got Earth, you got this. What's that about? So right. I try really hard not to do
that. You don't want to be that in England, essentially.
No, all the comics I admire are very personal and very, you know, and they should work anywhere. The show is you. You are the...
You're the showrunner of your act.
Yeah, so when people tell you, you know, but so I have an agent in England called Chris Lander, and he works at an agency called Phil McIntyre. If you're listening to this abroad, please email Chris. but I do that. And then when I come to Australia, I do it under the auspices of Melbourne Comedy Festival, which is, you know, the best curated comedy festival on the planet. Edinburgh is not curated. Anyone can go.
Really?
So it's a really, you know, difficult festival. You're on your own. Do whatever you want. But Australia, they really heavily curate their international comedians. And I wouldn't go to the festival without the permission of the, you know, the Melbourne festival itself. And they do a good job in terms of, I begged them to take this last show, because it hadn't been seen by anybody yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I just tried to keep reassuring them that it was good. And it was good. It's my best show. So I'm happy I did that. But like, you know, how do you get booked abroad? And why do you get booked abroad? I wanted to do longer, hour-long sets.
Mm-hmm.
And there were fewer of them in New York and LA. Okay. So I said I'm willing to travel and go do that. So anyone can go to Edinburgh. So I took a risk on Edinburgh.
Right.
Thankfully paid off in 2014. So that's how things got started. And, you know, now I want to do fewer hour long sets, to be honest with you.
Really?
But yeah. I haven't posted it anywhere yet because I think we're still working out the details, but I'm going to be doing, I'm doing this show at Montreal Just for Laughs for a few days.
Gosh,
yeah.
Amazing.
Which is cool. Hmm. And, but yeah, I now end up doing mostly 1 hour sets. So I probably do more 1 hour sets than I do, regular shows.
Wow. Wow. But like you so prefer it, clearly.
Vastly prefer being on stage. I'm one of those comics who, the longer I'm on stage, the, I think, I'm more comfortable an audience feels around. I think I'm low-key weird. You know? You
said your last show was your best show.
The show I'm doing now.
Yeah. What makes it the best show? Like, are you most proud of it and people laugh the most? Like, it's the stories that you tell? What is it for you that makes you, like,
got
say
a
that?
Compelling story. I went to this meeting of white nationalists in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Just sat in the back. And then eventually someone's like, "You're a Jew, right?" And I was like, "Yeah." So then it sort of kicked off. Sort of, that's the show.
You really did that?
Yeah.
What? What compels you to do that?
Just want to get out of the house.
Out of comedy?
You know?
No.
Just want to get out of the house a bit.
Go get a bite to eat.
I'm fascinated by it personally.
Like, I do that. But don't go. You're not aren't you fascinated by the white nationalism?
A little bit. I'm
totally fascinated.
I'm like, how could you hate me?
Don't they just
so
kick
much?
Your ass right there? Oh, it's a
no,
Jew.
They don't kick, no one kicks anyone's ass anymore. It's such an extreme thing. I'd be shocked if anyone's gotten their you know.
They call you names, they throw pennies at you, anything?
No one threw pennies at me.
Pennies.
They asked me to leave.
Oh, that's it.
I left.
But was it like leave Jew, or was it like, hey, we would like you?
One
to...
or two people were
was
like,
"I can Schindler's List, goodbye Jews,
goodbye Jews."
My favorite
goodbye,
line.
Goodbye Jews. One or two people asked me to leave a bit more aggressively than others.
Oh, no.
I think there was one girl who felt pretty betrayed that I was Jewish because I think we had kind of like hit it off.
Oh no!
Yeah. So the show is about that.
It's like Kyle Schindler's Hitler, list, right? Where he's like, "Oh, my maid's hot." Shit.
Oh. It was great though. It was really cool. And as I was sitting there, I was like, "This is my show." I've heavily fictionalized it. Heavily,
right?
Sure. You know, just for so many different reasons. Most of them technical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that heavy fiction. I don't know. I've changed some details mostly for safety's sake. My friend David Burstein, who's a really smart political commentator, I tried to get him to go with me, and so I told him about it the next day, and he was like, "This should talk about it. Should be a show." And my friend Chloe Ifshin is a really funny comedy person, talented comedy person, said you should do it. So I wrote it up, and you know, just from the stuff that I learned writing on that sitcom, and you know, a few years of just being away from the form, I just think it sort of came together and hangs together pretty well. And it's very personal. My girlfriend is a comic and she really encouraged me. She saw an early preview of the show and did not like it. And sort of let me know that, you know, she wasn't really moved by it. And so I put a lot of work into, you know, improving it and just making it a little more personal by degrees. But I think also my girlfriend knows what stuff is made up.
Right.
So I think, it, you know, she's like, oh, God, you know, like I say, my brother's a twin on stage, but he's not a twin. I do that because one day a joke was, I changed it instead of looking like twins to actually being twins. And it got a laugh that was so much bigger that it justified the lie to me.
That's
and now I kind of enjoy it.
I feel like when I researched you, it said that you have a twin brother.
I don't have a twin brother. AJ is not my twin. I did it on Conan. So I keep getting emails from all these people who are like, I'm a twin too. It's a special bond. And I was like, oh, fuck.
My oh, mom fuck. Was a twin.
Is it a special bond? Is it a special, does she feel specially about it? Like, people ask me, can you feel she your brother's pain? I'm like, nope, because we're a year and a half apart. So
that's, speaking of your brother, let me bring this up quickly. He's actually an Israeli Olympian.
Yes, he is.
Winter Olympics.
Yeah, Winter Olympics.
The skeleton is his sport.
Yes, correct. The past Winter Olympics.
So
the,
is he like a great Israeli Olympic champ? Like, when he, is he...
Great
he's
Israeli.
American, though,
he's
right?
a great Israeli Olympic.
Did they go
Olympic?
Back and, you know,
he trained there at the Wingate Institute in Netanya, which has, you know, been around since before the state of Israel
I
and
know.
Has facilities that reflect so, that. It's a real piece of shit.
Well,
place,
they don't really have snow.
They don't have snow. He trained in Germany. What it would, and on stage, sometimes I'll say he trained in Germany in what must be the irony of all ironies. But he made the Olympics.
But is there a competition somehow with you? In, like, I have a brother.
No,
you know, there's some
not
kind
at
of natural
all.
Competition to be
Absolutely
better.
Absolutely 0% now.
Really?
When we were kids, maybe there was, I think, I remember us being very competitive as kids, just like, you know, who would do this sport thing. But, you know, the one I feel baddest for is I've got this youngest brother, Austin, who's really smart and talented and interesting. He's a rising junior, I guess, at MIT. Mm-hmm. No, he's about to be a sophomore.
Wow.
And he's by far the most intellectual of us and normal, and I worry that our odd pursuits will sort of shove him in a weird direction. But whatever he does, he'll be a success at. But AJ is AJ, my brother, mm-hmm. the Olympian, he's really interesting. He's done really well in that thing. I think he's got to figure out his next move. It's hard. You know, these guys, they devote their lives. Almost all of the Olympians have this problem. They devote their lives to this pursuit. And a pursuit is not a career.
And then
right?
they become real estate agents.
What?
And then
they become real estate agents. So, you know, that's not a terrible life.
That
but
was
like,
my real estate agent.
Really? Was an Olympian?
She wasn't.
Wait,
I mean,
wasn't your real estate agent also the one that claimed that she was the my Sharona? Was it my Sharona or
what?
Like... You had somebody, I thought, in your life that like claimed...
Her son, though, plays for the... Now he got traded to the Brewers, but he used to play for the Miami
Marlins. Somebody
told
me a story. There's a real estate agent who... Her name is Sharona.
And she claims to be my
Sharona. She is.
That's
the one
mine.
That my Sharona was written about.
Well,
oh, okay.
That's really weird and strange, but...
Random, but...
But, you know, I really love... I love that my brother did a weird thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think there need to be more weird Orthodox Jews. I'm not kidding. I think Orthodox Judaism as a whole is very staid, and it's really a very set box.
Mm-hmm.
And I love parts of my religious cohort, but there are other parts of it that, like, I still go to, you know, every Wednesday morning I go to a coffee bean and tea leaf and this, you know, and listen to this guy talk about, you know, Judaism and spirituality and stuff like that. And it's an Orthodox guy. But, you know, I can count on two hands the amount of, like, Orthodox guys who work in television or entertainment or have jobs that are of note because of how unusual and strange they are. So
right.
I wish that would change.
Yeah, I think they got a bad rap, too.
Come on, Jews.
Come on,
Let's
Jews.
Not work
Jews
on
in
this,
general.
Please.
Orthodox Jews. Orthodox Jews.
I mean, I went to school. My school was Orthodox, actually.
What was your school?
Yeah. Well, I went to school in New Jersey.
Which
so
one?
It was Lakewood Hebrew Day School.
Wow, that's pretty. That's hey, yeah.
Lakewood is, there are more Jews in Lakewood than anywhere else in the United States. I think Israel is the next closest place where there are like more Orthodox Jews. A
lot of Jews
yeah,
in
it's
Lakewood.
Jew-ful.
My dad
very
was
Jew.
Born in Antwerp, which is very Orthodox
Wow,
Jew.
My grandfather is from Antwerp.
Really?
Yeah, that's, yeah, Flemish, very Flemish place.
Maybe
yeah.
they know each other.
Welcome that's to horrible. Jew Chat.
now we can do Jew Chat.
So two more questions for you
Sure,
here.
Go ahead. Sorry if there's, you know, if I
this is great.
No,
it's exactly what we
great.
Want.
Oh,
what do you consider your biggest failure?
Oh, gosh, I've had so many, man. You know, maybe I should have... instead of writing my second show, settle down and take advantage of some heat that was built up off the first show. But I had this real desire to keep doing, you know, live comedy. And there are different TV shows that I got close to being on. There are so those small career disappointments and things like that. But my biggest failure, I don't know. I'm tempted to say I've had a tough time handling my ADHD sometimes. And I was medicated in high school, and then I'd completely gone off the medication.
By choice,
but you know, I probably should even now find a good replacement for it. But it just made me so unhappy that I've just completely stopped doing it. And you know, I have generated material sometimes at, you know, prodigious rates with the right amount of focus and drive. And I don't know if you can chemically reproduce that because I've never in a healthy way because I've never done it. But sometimes I'm not sure if my brain is normal or if my brain is less attentive than the average one. So I'm really not sure what to do about it. And I wish I had gone years ago to somebody to figure it out. This is weirdly just a very internal failure, mm-hmm. I think, as opposed to an external.
And that's fine. And you know what, though? There's always time.
I'm still failing. I really should go to a good... this is so personal. No, I go to a good therapist right now, but... Mm-hmm. But
for the meds thing.
Yeah, I should go to a pharma psychiatrist or something like that. Yeah, I really should
go.
Do you? Mm-hmm. I should go see a psychiatrist probably.
With the advice of, though, my therapist was like, hey, you know, I know like we're working on X, Y, and Z, but like sometimes just like a little change in like your brain chemistry can do all the difference. So she gave me a number for a psychiatrist and they kind of fix you and you try out. Sometimes not all medications are the best and you figure it out.
I just don't know if my, because I... You know, I do get a lot of flack from my girlfriend for just, you know, always going to see a new thing. Like, you know, if I met someone who was like a plumber and was like, do you want to ride with me on a house call? I'd be like, yeah, sure.
I would. That sounds,
you know,
cool.
Like, that's sort of my life because all of the good stuff for me has happened because of that. You know, like going to England because this woman went, do you want to be in a play? Or, you know, studying abroad my last semester. Part of me wishes I'd stuck with baseball. That's a bit of a failure, you know. Like yeah. I could be, you know, I was a hotshot for like 2 years. 2 years I was a really like interesting baseball employee. I was very young. I was really an outside the box thinker in that one specific box. And then I got moved to other boxes, and they were like, "This guy doesn't belong in this box. He should not be working in baseball." But
don't,
you know,
let people tell you what box you belong in.
There's something to be said. We just, like we talked about at the beginning, being working in an office is a good experience in understanding how to work in a box. And you should work. I would
work in boxes. People.
I would change a few things. But you know what? For the most part, I've had a billion little failings. But you know, I haven't done anything externally hugely different. There are different times I thought, should I have fired this manager or should I have gone with this agent? Or
right.
Should I have worked harder on this writing packet or should I have done this audition a different way? And I've had a million of those. I have one every day. I wish I could go back in time and like, you know, buy more Bitcoin or some shit like that. But you know, that's not how life works. Right. So I don't dwell too much.
Okay. Last question for you. What's your favorite charity?
What's my favorite charity? Can I give a long answer and then a short answer?
Sure.
Okay. My favorite charity type, and you can find this out, is any charity that spends a lot of its operating budget actually doing the thing that it's supposed to do. And when I was working at the Red Sox, one of my jobs was giving out grants for the Red Sox Foundation. And we found, we had to read all these filings that these nonprofits file through Ogden, Utah.
Right.
And the government has them, and you can request them from every charity. You can request these forms that show you their financials. Charities have to be very transparent. So if you ever want to give to a charity, especially if you want to give a huge amount of money to a charity, ask to see their finances because they have those. They're publicly available, and they're available to donors. And I don't think people realize that. So, like, you know, I take real issue with some bigger charities that would apply for grants, and then you check and you'd see they spent like 20% of their operating budget.
That's what they say about Susan G. Komen, I heard.
Sure, 20%. Susan G. Komen. I actually have real issues with Susan G. Komen because I think that the family is intensely political and has given some donation money to political campaigns. And yeah, there are a lot of people in the breast cancer community take real issue with Susan G. Komen. My favorite charity, I love, it's not as important as some others. I love Major League Baseball's RBI initiative of reviving baseball in inner cities.
I like that right there. We're going to give $100 to that charity in your name. Yes.
Wow.
There you go. Just for you being, you feel like there's regret. Yeah. Should it have been a different charity? What happened?
One more charity. Well, I also don't know if it's still a specific charity, but here's a charity I'd like for you to give, and you actually get something out of this.
Okay.
My friend Yashar Ali, who's a great journalist on Twitter, Yashar bought me an elephant through the Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. They adopt these orphaned elephants in Africa, $50 a year. And if you're going to give $100 or something, I would love for you to save two elephants.
Let's save two elephants. That's what we're going to do. Give me the name of it one more time.
The DSWT, and the SWT is the Sheldrick Wildlife
Trust. We'll put
that in
the show notes.
Yes, there will, of course, be a link to
that. Thank you. That is wonderful. That is such a huge deal. That's so nice.
We're glad you came. You are on Twitter at the Alex Edelman.
No, that's my Instagram. My Instagram is the Alex Edelman.
Oh, you're Alex underscore Edelman?
I'm just Alex Edelman on Twitter.
Oh, okay. Because you were, at one point, you were Alex underscore Edelman.
And years ago, I killed Alex Edelman, and I got his Twitter name. That's how it works.
Okay, and so now you're just Alex Edelman on Twitter and the Alex Edelman on Instagram.
Should I plug dates or no?
Yes, please.
I'm in Boston in July. In Edinburgh. If you're in England at all in August 1st through 26th, please come to that.
I might actually be there.
Really? Ooh. Oh, my God. Please come. It's going to be such a good show. The show's called Just For Us. And, I put all my dates up on my Facebook page, Alex Edelman. And, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you again. Thank you, everybody, for listening to Failing Up.